You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence is brought to you from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and also put together for this episode on the stolen lands of the Wadawurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I would like to acknowledge elders past, present and emerging and extend that respects to any First Nations listeners tuning in today. Sovereignty was never ceded. I also like to acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and we must walk with First Nations people in their journey to get truth, justice, restitution, sovereignty and treaty. Please enjoy your Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence meditation.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush.
The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
It's a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Hello, podcast listeners. This is Amy. My pronouns are she, her, and they, them. I have a sore throat and sound a little croaky today. I am making a point at the moment of separating the live show from the podcast. So what you're hearing today happened on the live show, minus the usual radio shenanigans and music. This is partly because of the music that I play on the radio will get flagged if I include it in the podcast that ends up on Spotify or iTunes. If you like listening back to the radio episode as it happened, you can find the latest episode on the top of the Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence webpage at 3cr.org.au/killyourlawn. You can also find there a link to the RSS feed by clicking on the chain link icon in that little recording window, and then it will show you an orange button that says RSS feed. If you copy that link and add it to any of your podcasting libraries, it will give you the feed of all the previous radio episodes that Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence has done. The other reason I'm doing things this way is also to just deliver a nice, cleaner podcast experience. So on with the show. In today's episode, you hear my first suburban hellscape segment, and then following that, I include a little bit of tips and tricks from the previous episode's show, where I share a little bit about getting started with growing indigenous plants in your garden. It's pretty basic information, but if you haven't done it before, or you've had trouble growing indigenous plants before, then maybe some of the tips I provide will help you. Enjoy the show.
These are pretty big, pretty scary numbers. The people who put them together are looking at, you know, excess deaths during heat waves, so analysing, you know, how many people are dying in different areas at different points of time.
It's a movement that's going on, you know, the criminalisation of the unhoused, the criminalisation of poverty.
Perhaps they still matter, but we're getting to this point where we need to think about the city as the place where we struggle. Well, that brings every other struggle together. Yeah.
That's right, it's time to jump in the car and go for a trip to check out the burning hot asphalt roads, cracked concrete pathways, luscious lawns of astroturf, and to take a look at our cities, towns, and suburbs and work out what on earth is going on. This week on Suburban Hellscapes, we learn a little bit about how capitalism and colonialism have shaped our cities and suburbs. After that, we look at Armstrong Creek Urban Growth Area, one of the newest suburbs of the city of Greater Geelong, and how it reflects the ideas we are learning about today. So, you might have caught the episode I did about a year ago, where I interviewed David Border-Giles about something called the right to the city. It comes from French Marxist philosopher André Lefebvre and his 1968 work, The Right to the City. Suburban Hellscapes will be drip-feeding you the writings and thinkings of Lefebvre and those that followed him over the episodes to come. But today, I will introduce some concepts from his chapter on industrialization and urbanization, with a little down-under twist. Why a down-under twist, you ask? Well, The Right to the City is a short 80-page book that takes a fairly Eurocentric look at urbanization. While some attention is paid to the continent of Africa, the United States of America, and Southeast Asia, most of the writing is following Western history, largely focused in the Northern Hemisphere. So while much of the work applies to Australian society since the invasion of 1788, it doesn't account for things like Terra Nullius. You see, European countries have quite limited space for urban sprawl. So they have to build smaller and often upwards rather than outwards, which is a contributor, along with climate change, for the concept of the 15-minute walkable city. Whereas Australia has always behaved as a colonial power that continues to perpetuate the legal fiction of Terra Nullius, the idea that this land belonged to no one before invasion.
There's a pagan moon rising from the coral sea, red as the embers of his fire. The old man sits alone while his village people sleep. Dreams of his children are so dark.
Crystal West, with her dedication to her grandfather, Eddie Mabo, the Torres Strait Islander man who proved in the high courts that Terra Nullius was a legal fiction. those with the most power and wealth in Australian society view this land, whether they are conscious of it or not, as being up for grabs. From a capitalist perspective, they are right too, because despite Terra Nullius being proved a legal fiction in the high courts, there was no significant change to who held power and wealth. The Federation of Australia has a constitution that is based on the idea of this place that we live in belonging to no one, and being a boundless opportunity for capital. Our situation is closer to that of the United States of America, except that our political system, history, and environment has led to some different outcomes around urbanization, which is also partly due to the United States of America. You see, Australia has always been an outpost for Western imperialism in the Southern Hemisphere. Whether it is the British Empire or the American Empire, or both through AUKUS, we do not build our own futures. We have no rights to our cities that aren't first approved by the capitalist and imperialist powers. But this is where Lefebvre can give us some answers. You see, he writes a lot about the overs of European cities. Prior to industrialization and the rise of capitalism, European cities were like ongoing works of art that reflected the realities of the times that shaped them. Take a look at ancient Rome, and you see relatively unproductive monuments to the Roman Empire and their vast wealth. You are also witnessing, etched into every stone and every column, the work of slave labor. When industrialization comes with the rise of the bourgeoisie, aka those who own the factories, the mines, and so forth, with the rise of this class of people, major cities logically become centers of commerce and exchange which undergo radical changes. Smaller towns and villages experience this to some extent as well. Peasants go from farmers and craftspeople to workers in factories and mines and so forth. Industrialization brings rapid growth to populations as machinery can produce huge surpluses. Exchange value becomes central to how those who own factories and production centers operate, which means that the class who own all the things exploit the labor of their workers in order to create a profit. There is only so much profit that can be made out of the materials to make things. If you and your mates have all the available work out there, then you can control the wages and conditions of the workers, which is where you can squeeze that sweet profit. Unless they unionize, of course. So how does this materialize with urbanization? Well, Lefebvre writes about the implosion-explosion of urbanization. You see, housing or population centers will pop up around where the money is. Depending on that country and its government, that could be shanty towns, apartments, or suburbs. There is also an implosion where places become run down and money leaves an area of a town, suburb, or city. This also often becomes classist and racialized. Why invest in the urban infrastructure of those you see as lesser, inferior, or criminal? It might not be a conscious thing of urban planners, real estate agents, landlords, property developers, and politicians, but it happens all too often. Another example is your typical regional town that's built on an industry. Think of the mining industry that a town might be built on, or logging. The town will experience rapid industrialization and urban development until the resource is depleted. The explosion will end and then the implosion proceeds. And this often leaves those regional towns abandoned, run down, and struggling. Lefebvre also writes about the changing nature of these sections of cities and how they reflect class and capitalism. Factories can become housing, for example. Think of what was once the working class suburbs or poor suburbs of your city. Here in Melbourne, places like Fitzroy, Burnley, Coburg, Brunswick have transformed with the implosions and explosions of the city over time and become affluent areas due to their proximity to the city centre of Melbourne. As urban sprawl has spread further outwards, and those places are now closer to where the money happens. Factories have become luxury apartments and microbreweries. Red bricks, which were a common building material for working class suburbs, are now heritage designer choices in these places. Bluestone alleyways for the poop man to collect your poop are now iconic places for you to walk in your leisure time. We might also call this today gentrification. The last Lefebvre point to make, for today at least, is that our cities and suburbs are not the people's. They do not belong to the people in a capitalist society. They are not about serving the needs of the people, but the interests of the capitalist class. They are the corporate organization of our society. And when you think about it, that's who owns most of the housing and who builds most of the housing. It's corporations. This has only become worse since Lefebvre wrote Right to the City.
Just let me mention these things and we will hear this stupid laughter coming from opposite. But none of that stupid laughter, Mr. Speaker, can in any sense refute any one of the facts which I now put. Facts of achievement during the third term. In that period, Mr. Speaker, Australia had record business investment levels, of which everyone in this country can be proud. And they were record business levels which were created by the explicit policies of this government. Very simple, Mr. Speaker, what we achieved was very considerable real wage restraint. That led to higher profit levels which went into record investment levels.
Neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is the reason why AI data centres have been fast-tracked. Because since the 1980s, thanks to the likes of Bob Hawke, there has been a constant watering down of the rules and regulations about what businesses can do. Things like tax exemptions are an example of this. Why? Simple. Because it's another way to increase profits. No tax on a project means less expenditure and more investment. Poor regulation and enforcement means the cheap construction, poor wages and exploitation of workers, unsustainable and short-term urban planning, destruction of vital ecology, and last but not least, the violation of unceded First Nations land. That is also one of the unique things to our situation here. That makes the right to the city more challenging to apply to our situation. How can we talk about reconceptualizing or pursuing a more, say, communist idea of the people's entitlements to housing and land when most of us, like myself, are trespassers on unceded sovereign lands of First Nations people? Genocide, sovereignty, and treaty are still unresolved here. So while Lefebvre's analysis and ideas are still useful, here in so-called Australia, we have to be walking and working in solidarity with First Nations people. A good example of this is the Renters and Housing Union. They have been working in solidarity with First Nations people and their objectives whilst championing tenant unionism. Tenant unionism is something that has blossomed out of the works of people like Lefebvre. And seeing as we have so many renters and marginalised people living in social housing, owned by the same people and the same corporations, it is a viable way to resist both capitalism and colonialism.
Want to become a socially progressive podcaster but don't know where to start?
3CR has a wealth of podcasting knowledge and experience, and we've developed a practical podcast training course to help community voices get into the world of podcasting.
Our two-day in-station course is perfect for new podcasters or people who want to improve their skills and get some insider tips.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
Full details at 3cr.org.au/podcast services.
Or call the station during business hours on 03 9419 8377.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Palestine. So we were chatting about The Right to the City by André Lefebvre and terra nullius and its effect on how our cities have been organised in Australia. And now we are moving to our first case study. That is the suburb of Armstrong Creek in the city of Greater Geelong. To understand the issues facing this suburb today, we have to go back to the original sovereign owners of the land, the Wadawurrung people of the Kulin Nation. The borders of the Wadawurrung stretched east to Werribee, west as far as Eyre's Inlet, and north as far as Beaufort and Black Hill. It also includes Ballarat. There were 25 clan groups prior to invasion, and there is evidence of a significant population with sophisticated horticultural and agricultural practices. That is important because most of the Australian history books lowball First Nations populations prior to invasion significantly. But this land has the most ancient farming projects in the world, which are a signifier in anthropology of a civilization's ability to support large populations. The current traditional owners organization, the Wadawurrung Traditional Owners Aboriginal Corporation, represents seven family groups descended from one surviving Wadawurrung person known as John Robinson. John Robinson was found by Gundudjmara people living alone in the bush, and through that encounter, a piece of Wadawurrung history and bloodlines survived. There are also other claims of traditional owner recognition happening at the moment, so there may have been more than one survivor. However, we are still only talking about a handful of survivors from an entire nation of thousands. So the Armstrong Creek urban growth area sits in South Geelong between Mount Deneed and Lake Connerori. Prior to invasion, it was mostly wetlands, floodplains, and grasslands. The urban development area stretches a massive 2,500 hectares and is expected to provide 22,000 residential buildings housing 55 to 65,000 people. Now that is an explosion. This has been a project for some years now, and there are now many residents calling this home. It features some beautiful wetlands overseen by Barwon Water in collaboration with Wadawurrung Traditional Owners, which is public land and management, and of course many, many large, unsustainable, cheap houses on the land being developed by those corporate property developers.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
Little Boxes by Malvina Reynolds. You have probably noticed if you have visited new suburbs in Victoria that wherever they are, they are identical looking. I often say, if you knock me out in one suburb and then drop me off in any other one in Victoria, I wouldn't know if I was in Geelong, Northern Melbourne, Mornington Peninsula, or anywhere else. The only way I might be able to tell the difference is in their maintenance, which could be reflective of the disinvestment, classism, and racism that often makes its way into our urban environments. Armstrong Creek is built on wetlands and floodplains. Now Barwon Water has built and restored many fabulous wetlands and built infrastructure to, quote, develop on redirecting or obstructing floodwater, stormwater or drainwater, and the effect of the development on reducing flood storage and increasing flood levels and flow velocities, end quote. Essentially, they are maintaining stormwater catchments, wetlands, and drainage systems to manage flood levels and the flow of water through the town. Fingers crossed, with the oncoming extreme weather events of climate change, it will be enough. But unfortunately, the housing built by property developers is not on the same standards. In fact, going for a drive through the suburb, you will witness what appears to be cheap migrant labour working for cowboy construction companies. My immediate concern is the welfare of those labourers, because I have witnessed many of these labourers without adequate personal protective equipment in dangerous situations. But the other thing this indicates is, yet again, the labour of the workers being exploited to make a profit. These new builds and new suburbs all across Victoria are finding themselves and online forums and social media with new owners and tenants finding that there are major structural issues with these new homes. Foundations sinking, rendering cracking and underground utilities not being buried deep enough. I had a mate at a workplace who was living in one of the new suburbs up in northern Melbourne, and this was a man who'd worked in construction, who knows all about, you know, dial before you dig. He barely dug at all and he hit a gas main. By the way, if you are digging in your home and you want to make sure you are not hitting important utilities like gas mains, I recommend giving Dial Before You Dig a call or your local council. And this is a consequence of neoliberalism and the lack of regulation around building projects. We do need to house our population, but that is not the main goal of property developers. They are corporations trying to make money, which is why there is so much propaganda to brainwash people into believing that the only way is the madness that we are pursuing. Should also add here about these new builds is that there is very little garden space in these new houses. It looks almost to be 90% house and 10% garden, with a tiny, tiny bit of lawn out the back, if you've got lawn out the back, or a tiny little front section of your house with a bit of lawn, maybe a nature strip. I've also witnessed driving around Armstrong Creek inconsistency with houses having or not having stormwater tanks. You see, gardens and stormwater tanks can help manage stormwater and floods because the water will go into your ground where it falls rather than flowing into drains and rivers. So what was the land being used for before the Armstrong Creek urban growth area was developed? Its history since invasion reflects both what we were talking about earlier in the show and the typical history of land and landowners throughout so-called Australia. So, the first question becomes, who was Armstrong? This is the question local historian and academic Anne Hodgkinson answers in her essay on John Armstrong. John Armstrong was a shepherd who became a pastoralist, as many settlers and convicts did in colonial Australia's beginning. You see, Geelong was one of the major producers of wool in colonial Australia. John Armstrong was a very successful pastoralist with land leases throughout colonial Victoria, whose wealth became intergenerational, with his 12 children to also become prosperous graziers and people of influence. This family dynasty then covered Victoria, New South Wales, and Queensland. This is how many settler families achieved wealth in Australia, and the idea of this being a land of opportunity comes from. However, we have to remember that this is off the back of genocide and ecocide. Think of Palestine with the Nakba, where since 1947, Palestinians have been killed and dispossessed of their land for the prosperity of Israeli colonizers. We also see the destruction of indigenous ecologies during this time, which is what happened in Armstrong Creek. You see, in order to set up his grazing industry, John Armstrong, like so many other pastoralists, cleared land, brought invasive species of plants, and had foreign animals that compacted and changed the soil. You can see it in the paddocks waiting for housing within the development zone today. Little to no native vegetation with the grazing plants for a European animal husbandry. The soil is dry and cracked, and many smaller creeks and ponds just no longer exist. First Nations peoples are stewards of nature. They care for country. So when genocide and ecocide comes to the land, the remnants, such as wetlands, are never truly cared for like they were prior to invasion. Wherever you go in Victoria today, you will see the outer suburbs touching agricultural land. And if you watch those spaces over time, you will see that agricultural land that was once pristine country being leveled with bulldozers and replaced with concrete, roads and houses. So this is where Terra Nullius returns. This is all just land up for grabs without reconciling with the brutal history of ecocide and genocide. Well, that's certainly a lot to take in. We haven't even talked about the environmental costs of the design of these suburbs, but we will and more in the next episode of Suburban Hellscapes. we will also ask who lives in Armstrong Creek today. We'll be inspecting the drains at these suburbs to see what does it look like for a house to be built on a wetland and floodplain. Will they survive the 21st century? And we will hear First Nations perspectives on what life was like after invasion with the missions and working for John Armstrong, because he was actually an employer of First Nations people. Until next time, you've been listening to a fresh Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence segment with me, Amy. We now return to the rest of the show.
We now return to the previous fortnight's episode, where I share some tips and tricks on how to grow Indigenous plants in your garden. A lot of people struggle to get them started, and hopefully these tips and tricks will help you and help you not to give up as well, because gardening really is a process of trial and error.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a container deposit scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
We're going to talk a little bit about killing lawns. I've made myself a target. Every week I'm going to say something about killing lawns, if you're interested. I think a good one to start off with is planting Indigenous plants. Sometimes they die on you. Oh no, what do I do? This is a very good question. First of all, always try and source your plants from a non-monopoly source. By that I mean, please don't buy your plants from Bunnings. Bunnings, I remember growing up, there were local hardware stores. They're pretty much a thing of the past. You can only find franchised hardware stores now. And Bunnings occupies an entire section of the market and has completely destroyed small business. And it's funny because it's like the lowest prices are just the beginning. We'll compare and match prices. Who are they comparing matching prices with if they've knocked everyone out of the competition? Because the other franchises out there, they're more professional-oriented tools. So honestly, it's not good. And they're coming for the horticultural area of business. They're coming after your local nurseries. You know, they're in danger of shutting down. And local nurseries have far better stock than Bunnings. They have better products. I can probably share this product because the Gardening Show have mentioned them many times on 3CR, but there's an Australian-owned potting mix called Grow Better, which is cheaper and far superior quality to any of the potting mixes you get in Bunnings. And they only sell at your local nurseries, not at Bunnings. So you're actually, you know, benefiting by going to local nurseries, community cooperatives, our good friends at Basalt Buddies. Please avoid them as much as you can. Obviously, you can't avoid them for everything because, again, they have a monopoly on huge sections of hardware and horticulture. They also sell you pots that don't have drainage very commonly, and which is going to kill your plants because plants need drainage. But anyway, I digress. I have some simple advice for growing native plants, and one is starting with a reputable buyer and supporting local business. The other thing is ask your whoever you're going to, if you're buying shrubs or trees, ask them if they've grown said shrub or tree from a cutting or from a seed. You want to buy plants that are grown from seed, because a cutting is where you take a little cutting off a plant, like a little branch, a very small piece, and maybe you apply some chemicals to it. Maybe you just stick it in some water. Maybe you just stick it in some soil, and it grows roots. And you have a version of that plant. But what that is a clone of that plant. Whereas if you collect seeds, particularly from the area that they're growing in, which is hopefully the area that you live in, what you get in when you grow them and then distribute them is that you are strengthening the genetic integrity of those plants. Because if you have one species of plant and you distribute thousands of it and it's just a clone, you are not helping local endemic indigenous ecologies. You're actually weakening their genetic integrity, and you could lead to that to a failure in that plant being restored in our local urban environments, and also broader in urban environments. When it comes to putting native plants in the ground, a lot of people think you can just put them in the ground and forget about them. All plants, particularly your baby plants, need stewardship. And people think, oh, well, if this grew in the local area that I grew up, that I'm in for thousands and thousands of years, then surely this plant will just exist and go wild, just take back the land. Your soil has been affected by 200 plus years of colonial interference. It's been compacted. It's been farmed. It's been through so many things. And it's also had a huge plethora of species of plants and insects, microbial life and fungal life that was not here for thousands of years that is now in that space. So those things all come together to create an ideal habitat, ideal soil structure, an ideal life to support the plants that have been there for thousands of years, but it's all been messed with. So actually your new indigenous plants require care, and they require ongoing stewardship by you. And a very simple thing that you need to do is water them. A lot of people think, oh, they're indigenous, they don't need much water. Generally speaking, most plants that are brand new in the ground need extra help, and they need watering. Always make sure that you plant your plants level with the soil. So that means at the base of your plant, you have the soil in its pot, and you want that base where the plant meets the soil in the pot to be level with the soil in the ground. It's really important. And then always read those little tags, and if you can't get them, get the person who sells them to you to give you that information on how it's cared for, its position in the sun, and its watering requirements, knowing that you'll probably have to water it a bit extra. The rain will often not give you enough water. The rain does not count as watering. Unless you get a torrential rain, your plants might not really get that much water. You need deep watering from a watering can. So that's some good advice, in my opinion, from someone who's done horticulture and worked in the industry, for caring for your plants. And then, as I was saying, your garden might have had grass in it from South Africa, because most of our grasses for lawns are from South Africa, or other plants from across the world, and they've changed the biome, they've changed the ecosystem on a micro level in the soil, and they've changed it in other ways. Plants, the animals that interact with plants are different, humans are now impacting them. So your baby plants need a lot of care. You need to be careful that they're not getting trodden on. And you need to make sure that your plants... sorry, I just lost my train of thought. That's not good. I've only got minutes left. that's what I was going to say. You need to forgive yourself if your plant dies, because your plant is trying to find its home, and it's trying to create an ideal environment for itself. That's what it does in the ground. It sends out chemicals through its root system to make the ground and the soil around itself its home. So that is why a lot of people love trees, because trees do that on a larger scale, and then you can plant smaller plants around them. But that is something you got to forgive yourself. Sometimes you just got to keep trying, even though you've done your best with a plant and it dies. I recommend not going with ground covers that are fragile at first. I recommend indigenous grasses and when it comes to small ground covers, because they are tend to be a bit hardier and they can get started before you plant little things. Plus, the snails tend to eat the little things.
Thanks again for listening. That's it for the show today. Thanks again for listening to the show. You can always follow the latest episodes and latest podcasts on this show at 3cr.org.au/killyourlawn. You can follow the show on Instagram at 3cr_kill_yourlawn. And you can always write to the show by sending an email to kylkyf@proton.me. See you in a fortnight's time.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.